Thanks, Chad. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it. As Chad said, I'm going to present results from a recent search that we finished on LIGO and Virgo data. We were searching for low mass systems. And I'm also going to go into a little bit of future thinking towards advanced LIGO and talk about some of the new problems that we're trying to tackle and how we want to make better searches for the future in advanced LIGO. And wait, there we go. Okay, so I'll start with a little bit of motivation. Oh, hockey stick. Okay, so I will tell you what CBCs are. CBC stands for compact binary coalescence. So these are binary stars. I'll just briefly go over why we care about these things and why we think they're exciting. And then I'll get to the results of the low mass search. This was LIGO's sixth science run and Virgo's second and third science run. And I in particular was working on the interpretation of the results in terms of event rates. I analyzed the efficiency of the search and the sensitive volume. And then in advanced LIGO, there's some new issues that we have to deal with. We're going to have more templates. The instruments are going to be more sensitive. And one of the downsides of that is there's more things that we can see. We have to search for them. But we have ways to deal with this. And we had good latency in S6, and we want to maintain that latency or improve it for advanced LIGO so that we can follow up on gravitational wave triggers with telescopes. And we have improved waveform models that weren't available a few years ago. And we want to incorporate these into the new searches. Okay. So this definition, when I say compact binary coalescence, I really mean the in-spiral merger and ring down of either two neutron stars, two black holes, or a neutron star and black hole. There are other compact objects that could coalesce, such as white dwarfs, but I'm not talking about those. Sometimes I will be sloppy and use the word merger to refer to compact binary coalescence. That really means all three things. There's a lot of interesting things that happen at this coalescence phase of a binary neutron star's life. So neutron stars are extremely dense entities, and so by studying the merger or the waveforms at the merger, we can understand the property of matter at such high densities. This will help us to validate or verify or disprove general relativity in the strong field, highly dynamical regime. There's not yet been a test at this level. I'm going kind of backwards here, but so there's also the story of the progenitor short hard GRBs, which at least some of them are thought to be caused by CVCs, but that association is not yet confirmed. So if we can achieve a low latency and point telescopes and catch these GRBs, or the other way around, CRGRB and find a gravitational wave, then we can make this association concrete. And then we also care about the generic properties of populations of neutron stars and black holes in nature. There are, I guess the first thing to point out about binary neutron stars is that they can form. And so the point of this slide here is to show that there's at least two mechanisms that we think can lead to the production of a binary system that's close enough to coalesce within the time scale of the universe. You can either have ordinary binary evolution, in which two ordinary massive stars undergo normal stellar evolution. One supernovas, and they survive the supernova. So here's a binary right here. You have a supernova. You could have the binary disrupting, but we're interested in the case in which the binary survives. And then the secondary ends up evolving and also undergoing a supernova. And if this system remains in close orbit after all this, then this is one possible mechanism for creating this. And another way to form a binary system is just binary capture. So you have two guys who have never seen each other before, and they get close to each other, they interact with the third, and as a result, they become bound after the third guy leaves. So it's important to distinguish between these two, because we expect the properties of the populations to be a little different. So the spin and orbital angular momentum is likely not aligned for the binary capture scenario. There's no reason for it to be. But in the binary evolution case, it's likely that the spin will be aligned. So this informs us a little bit on how we should search for these things. And conversely, when you make a detection, it tells you a little bit of how this system might have come to be. So if we find a system with highly unaligned angular momentums, that might tend to give credit to this binary capture form.
So when you say that the spin is aligned in the binary evolution scheme, is that because of the common envelope phase?
Yes.
So it's not necessarily true that the extra binary angular momentum and the black hole spin needs to be aligned.
Yes.
Prior to the, yeah. And the other perhaps question is, what roughly are all the branching missions? So, I mean, I know almost 100% of massive stars are binaries.
I have no idea what the answer is. Do you guys have any ideas? I don't know. I don't know that anybody...
Well, yeah, I don't know either, actually.
Well, there's not even an order of magnitude.
No, it's a very uncertain process. I don't know much about it. There are people who simulate these things.
Yeah.
And I'll touch briefly on that, but I don't know the details about it. Okay, and then after convincing you that these things can form, so they can form, and not only there's some mechanisms that can create these things, but also we've seen them out in the wild, and here's a table of six observed binary systems that are close enough in their orbital separation that they will merge in less than a Hubble time. There's some interesting features to point out about these. One of them is this double pulsar here. And the reason why that guy is important is because we actually have very accurate mass measurements of this. And well, not as accurate, we have spin measurements of this. And so we have a little bit of understanding of it's only one data point, but it's getting somewhere. There's also one associated with the globular cluster. B212711C. This is important because the fact that it exists in a globular cluster tends to suggest that it may have formed from binary capture instead of binary evolution. We have measurements for the spin.
And do you know if those are they aligned?
I don't know about the I don't know about the alignment. They're very slowly spinning, but I don't know about the alignment, so sorry. And then there's this other pulsar, the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, which is quite famous for its involvement in the confirmation of the orbital decay, predicted by general relativity. Okay, so now that I've established that they can form by some mechanism, that they do form by some mechanism, we want to know how many of them are there, because we don't want to spend all day searching for these things if they are just not really that common. So we have a few data points, and we can estimate from this how many binary pulsars there might be in the galaxy, because these things are only observed in the galaxy. So if you model the pulsar survey, and so VI is the volume surveyed, the volume of the galaxy surveyed by a pulsar survey, and V gal is just the volume of the galaxy, then by weighting the observed population by its lifetime, or the inverse of its lifetime, you can come up with an estimate for the merger rate in the galaxy. Okay, and the more recently, Caligara et al. Has used a Bayesian approach, trying to take into account more systematically uncertainties in the pulsar surveys. And they've come up with a number that's 2 per cubic megaparsec per million years. But it's very important to point out that there's only 3 data points. This is a very uncertain number. Okay, now we need to get out of the galaxy, though, because our instruments, the LIGO instruments, are becoming quite sensitive, and we can see beyond the Milky Way galaxy. We can even see beyond the local group of galaxies. We're out, actually, so for the binary neutron star search that I'm going to talk about, we're actually at about 35. So let's see, this is 10, 20, 30. 35 megaparsecs is our binary neutron star range. And at this point, we're approaching the regime in which, first I have to get you out of the galaxy. So in the steady state, you could say it, or it's been argued that the star death rate and the star birth rate are equal. And our populations come from dead stars. So we expect the amount or the number of binary neutron stars or binary black holes to be proportional to the birth rate of stars. And it's well known that blue light luminosity, at least in spiral galaxies, is a good tracker of star formation. And so you can use, by measuring the blue light luminosity of nearby galaxies, you can extrapolate the galactic rate to an extragalactic distance. Okay, and you do that at first because it's not, the distribution of your sources aren't uniform. We expect these things to happen in galaxies. And very nearby, it's inhomogeneous. But after a certain distance, the amount of blue light luminosity per unit volume becomes roughly constant. And this is useful. We can now talk about rates in terms of per unit volume instead of per unit L10. And that's important because if, for instance, you think that binary neutron stars come from elliptical galaxies, not spiral galaxies, then blue light luminosity is not going to be your tracker of choice. You're going to be interested in how much volume you can see.
So doesn't this depend on what the spiral time scales are, what the merger time scale, it takes almost a Hubble time. And I thought for neutron star binder, this was a long time, something like that. Then wouldn't you expect the rate to be correlated with the mass of star formation rate in the past? So not blue light today, but what you thought the star formation rate was a Hubble time ago, or something like that. Which would be good for you guys, because there's a lot more star formation in the past.
Yeah. So that's a good point, but actually, what do I want to say?
Maybe
yeah. So this is a critical assumption. This is the assumption is the steady state, and you're assuming that the steady state is occurring now. This is what Finney did. Am I getting this wrong? I guess the point is that you kind of want to be somewhat model independent in a sense, and that's part of the motivation for switching over to volume instead of L10s.
One of the earlier slides had the merger time scales.
Yes.
Some of them are pretty small, I think.
Some of them are a few hundred billion years.
Yeah.
So people, I think the slightly longer answers people have done, they try to get a constant information histories and all of that, and try to come up with better rate estimates.
I believe that's hard.
Yeah,
it's very hard.
It sounds
very
actually,
hard.
Well, so I think Richard Shaughnessy, when he was here,
yeah.
If I remember right, in some instances, that was in his talk.
Especially
for very massive binaries.
Right.
So yeah, it's hard business to do with this talk.
This gets to a slightly related question that I had. You said getting out of the galaxy, and I'm going to interpret that very locally.
Okay.
I know that the binary pulsars, right, that the binary neutron stars that they use, this group that I used to try to estimate the merger rates. These are frequently found at, you know, large vertical distances off the galactic disk and whatnot. And the interpretation for that, I thought, was you get this kick velocity information, and then if you live for a long time, okay, so that's hundreds of millions of years, I guess, then you can get far away from the disk. For black hole binaries, how different is that? So I thought the black hole kicks were a lot smaller. So does that mean that black hole binaries stay in galactic disks? Or do they also get into the halo?
I really don't know. Do either of you have an answer to that?
The kicks are related to how aligned the spins are. Like if they're anti-aligned, then you get a little
kick. Well, that's a kick at merger, maybe.
Yeah,
supernova.
Oh, supernova.
So if I had infinite LIGO and I was able to see every merger event in the galaxy, how many, you know, what fraction of those would I expect? Two orders of magnitude. In the disk of the galaxy, and what fraction would I expect in the halo? Would you ever see a black hole merger event in the halo, or is the kick always so small that it never get out of the disk?
It's smaller because the black hole captures more of its own neutrons. Neutrinos. Kick comes from like asymmetric neutrino bursts.
I thought it was all various hydrodynamic instabilities.
You answered Latham's question back.
He said he thought it was all the various hydrodynamic instabilities. That it's just the hydrodynamics.
We know supernovas are different, but very, very asymmetric. If you have a neutron star, then asymmetry means, you know, something bounced off one side harder. Black hole, then you add to that the fact that black holes tend to be massive, right? Its velocities are smaller by 20 or something. So black holes, I thought their kicks were not enough to design them, but I don't know how they get out.
Yeah, I'm not sure, and it's honestly something I've not thought too much about. I mean, there's pretty much zero chance that a gravitational wave strike would be able to distinguish alone will be able to distinguish the position
should
actually be in the halo or in the disk. So you'd have to have a counterpart for that. And in the case of black hole binaries, you're going to get a counterpart. So it might be that.
Unless it was an arc galaxy.
Sorry, unless it was
an arc. Unless it was an our galaxy.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
But is it concerned that this would alter the merger rates? That if black holes would form, you're always one of the galaxies?
Well, I mean, if they always unbind themselves, then I'm sure that would change the merger rates. But
yeah.
But that, no, I was just curious about where they are. I mean, this is one of the arguments for the double neutron stars being the short wave reverse, right? They're out in halos, not associated with star positions. So that's it. And so I have another ulterior motive, but I don't know.
Well, I think for the binary black hole mergers, the assumption is always that they're going to go off in their clusters. Because they would require these three body interactions to get them close enough. And so merges would occur.
Even with common envelope things, or does that not happen?
Well, I think the more recent, so like things like in like the X-ray, the low-mass X-ray batteries, or like with isotope X-ray, I guess, something like that. So these things that they think would be really important, because that would be an example of solar energy. Before that, a lot of the post models. To get fired by four rates up to being something like a good effect. A lot of people were relying on strange interactions with black holes. But I think those things have become a little less supported by the community.
Sorry.
So if I were to answer your question, I would like to say that it's just very uncertain. I actually don't know enough about the subject to say that decisively. I was hoping they would. But there are a lot of uncertainties in these calculations, for sure. And this is reflected in the fact that if you look at the various ways you can estimate the rates, and so far I have only mentioned one, which is extrapolating from the observed neutron star populations in our own galaxy. Another method would be population synthesis, where you model the binary evolution system based on what you think kick velocities are, and the kick distribution, and so forth. And when you take a survey of the numbers that are reported in the literature about what the rate merger rate should be, you find a huge variation between very low numbers on this side and very high numbers. Well, not I guess that's what, factor of 1,000. So it's about three orders of magnitude uncertainty. And then somewhere in the middle is where we think the actual truth is. So this column here indicates what is often quoted in LIGO as the merger rate, but it's very uncertain. And so this is actually where LIGO comes in. LIGO observations are going to help narrow this range down. Either without detections, we'll put upper limits on the rate and rule out certain evolution models or formation scenarios, or in the event of detections, we can put an interval on the rate and actually get it rule out either the high end or the low end or whatever. Okay, so this plot here is a this is the in-spiral horizon distance for our detectors during the sixth science run, and this is calendar days after S6. You can see that there's a lot of variation. This corresponds to changes in the instrument, upgrades, things like that. But we reach a horizon distance of up to 45 megaparsecs for binary neutron stars, which is the most sensitive the our instruments have ever achieved.
Would that be called the detection if only one of the detectors detect something?
No, we require coincidence.
So at least two detectors.
At least two detectors.
So the horizon distance went up to 40 or so.
Sure, yeah.
That's a good point where you're going with that. You're basically always limited by your
second sense to
this. Yes. So this is a very idealized calculation just based on Gaussian noise and what you would expect. The distance at which you'd expect an optimal oriented system to give signal noise is 8.
When you say distance, is that for one sigma detection? Or is that 6 sigma?
That's an SNR8. I don't know what that translates into into sigma.
In Gaussian noise, it would be pretty significant, and that's where it comes from. SNR isn't LIGO or funny things anyway, but I think it would be something like 5 sigma in our noise for Gaussian. But of course, it isn't. So, one has to think on faith that we can provide something similar with long fancy tricks.
Okay.
It's roughly true.
And that's the whole point of your mileage may vary. This is just the what we naively would expect or hope to get from our detector.
I thought that was like your mileage in terms of horizon distance actually did vary as a function.
Oh, yeah, that's it. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's not what I was intending.
I would take credit.
Okay.
It was a disclaimer. It doesn't really get
sued. Search parameters. Let's see. Okay, so this compares. I claim that this was the most sensitive search to date. This is, again, these are horizon distances, so this is not actual sensitivity measurements, but just estimates of it. And here is, I've also shown S5, the sensitivity of Hanford in the fifth science run, and Livingston in S5. And Virgo Science Run 2. And you can see Virgo Science Run 1, all three detectors improved over their previous performances. Virgo had a little bit of trouble in the third science run with one of the mirrors. We searched for binary systems with total masses less than 25 solar masses. And we were searching with a non-spinning Temple band. And that's it was 158 days. So we require coincidence, as I was mentioning. These are the four types of coincidences we can get with our three instruments, either all three detectors being on, Hanford and Livingston, Hanford and Virgo, or Livingston and Virgo. Okay, so that's the estimation of the sensitivity. But how do we actually measure the sensitivity of their instrument? Well, we do it by simulation. We simulate a population of binary neutron stars and binary black holes, and we measure the efficiency of detecting these events as a function of their source parameters, so the masses, the spins, the inclination, sky position, etc. And then we integrate we actually do a Monte Carlo integration over all the different source parameters to estimate the search volume, the actual volume of space that you can see. Okay, and in practice, what we really do is this here is an efficiency as a function of distance, a function of physical distance, but it's marginalized over all inclinations, all sky positions, end time, etc. And what we do is we just leave the efficiency as a function of distance and integrate the efficiency over distance to get the volume. And we set the search threshold at the loudest event, which is kind of a weird thing. So in this simulation, we consider it an injection or simulation found if it's louder than the loudest, I want to say foreground event, or zero lag event, but that's not a word that means any sense. We set it at the, so injections louder than this are considered found, and injections quieter than that are considered missed. Okay, so this is where I was. Oh, this is a plot you've seen already. Just reminding. This is so freaking annoying. Steve Jobs, man. Okay. Yes. Okay. So I'm just reminding you that because the search exceeds this nominal distance of 20 megaparsecs. In fact, we're considerably above that, even in the worst case. We don't have to take into account the actual granularity or inhomogeneity of the distribution of mass around us. And so we just assume that that sources are uniform in volume. And let's see. So there's in some cases, we have a natural choice of parameter of distribution for the parameters. But in the distance case, not so. We want to distribute it uniformly in volume, but the Monte Carlo convergence is very weak when you do it that way. So that's why in the previous slide that I was showing you, we actually integrate over the distance rather than evaluate that by Monte Carlo techniques. Okay, and did something get skipped? Okay, and all right, so this is how we estimate the rate, this equation here. It comes from taking the loudest event from your search and assuming that it is noise, or in fact not assuming that it's signal. So we basically make no statement about how many events we've seen. We say that we have seen one event or less, and then we essentially are marginalizing. So this is your basic Poisson factor, e to the mu vt, and we're marginalizing or interpolating between the case in which there are no events, and that corresponds to this term here, and the case in which there is one event, which corresponds to the term with the rate mu attached to it. And what's shown in this plot is the upper limit that's attained as a function of this interpolating parameter lambda. And what happens is you see it goes, it's kind of hard to see in this plot, but in fact it does go between 1.3 and 2.6 or 8. or something, but whatever number it is the, so this is the just basic Poisson upper limit for saying I have absolutely no events, and this is the Poisson limit for I have absolutely one event for sure. And so this kind of takes you in between. Is that clear? Okay, and what I was just describing is how we assess the sensitivity for a single search, but we actually break our search up into a number of smaller searches to keep up with the data, because we want to know if there's an event as soon as possible, and also to account for non-stationarity in the noise, which you can see in this plot. The noise here is a lot higher. Well, Virgo's a bad example. The noise here is a lot higher than the noises here. So we don't want to estimate our background in the same way for those two periods of time. So we break it up into chunks, and then we combine them in a Bayesian way. So we have a distribution on the rate, and we take the posterior distribution that we get from one mini search and use that as the prior for the next mini search. And there's also variation across different instrument sets. So the background in LIGO or in Hanford Living Sim, those type of coincidences are going to be a lot different than the background you see in Hanford Virgo, just because of differences in the instrument and differences in sensitivity.
Is there a single rate here because the mass function of black holes is strongly peaked? I mean, so you talk. I would guess that many astrophysical processes, the rate of them occurring might depend on the luminosity. For example, when you have many flares from stars that are relatively small, and occasionally you have a big one, right? Many smaller quakes. So I would then guess that the rate should be a function of how loud the. That's not the case, I guess, if you only have 10 solar mass bubbles.
Well, when I say rate, I'm referring to rate density, which means rate per unit volume per unit time.
Sure.
In terms of what that translates to into loudness, that depends on where you think your sources are. So, and how sensitive your detectors are.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think maybe he's talking about mass, and mass ratio.
And I
think it could depend on mass.
It does depend on mass, and what I'm showing here is for binary neutron stars. 1.4 on 1.4 solar mass.
That's why there's one right number of that within the, per cubic megaparsec.
Mm-hmm. So I think I see what you're getting at, and maybe I should have pointed this out previously on this slide. This shows the horizon distance as a function of total mass.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're asking, which
translates
into loudness, because more massive things are louder.
Well, but not only that, you might have more 8 solar mass black hole binaries than you have 10 solar mass. So you might expect a
lot. The one number we know is that nothing was seen in the
terms. Yeah, right. So then...
What's that, Kevin?
Well, the one number you know is that if you see, you've made no detection.
Yes.
But then that translates
to... No detections is not nothing was seen.
Right. That's
okay.
True.
And so this is what that one detection thing is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you could imagine that for some reason, you saw an enormous number of events that were all very light objects, for reasons we don't understand, and then that was the noise of the detector or something, right? But that would mean that you were looking at a rate of things and given luminosity. So when you say that you put this posterior probability on the rate, given the dubious identification of the loudest event as being something or not, that rate is, in some sense, the rate of objects of that loudness.
We actually do it. It really is made in a mass difference. Look at the end, and I think Steve's talking about neutron star binaries right now. But at the end, we actually do it both as a function of mass. Not as a rate density in mass. We're across the end, but we play literally as saying if everything is within this mass range, all sources are within this mass range, what would the upper limit be?
Right. And that must help you identify.
Well,
how relevant that loudest event was, then, right?
So
there's some funny issues, right? Because that allows you to then go and match a particular template, but then you use that to set an upper limit on the, you know, you don't use that as not going for that template. You don't say, well, I only saw one event like that. You just say, you saw nothing in the detector of this, which corresponds to being able to see it that far.
I see.
Anything closer than these curves within Lambda.
And you're saying that if you just use the wrong templates, then that's a systematically wrong statement?
Yes. There's also there's an implicit assumption here about the mass distribution, which, as you pointed out, we don't really know. So,
well, but for the neutron neutron star case,
yeah, in that case, well, the neutron star case, we have a good understanding of the mass distribution, but for higher mass black holes, we don't. And in that case, we just choose a uniform distribution component mass, and that, you know, the validity of your answer depends on the validity of that assumption.
But it is recorded as a function of mass. People
yes.
basically do whatever they want to that fact. Mm-hmm. If you have your favorite model, you want to get a rating on that model.
Okay, yes, this is as a function of mass. So these shaded bars, or these hatched bars here, give the upper limits that were derived from S5 and previous observations. And these tiny little gray bars are the results of the upper limits obtained from the S6 observations plus, including the S5 observations as prior. These blue boxes indicate the range of astrophysically non-insane possible numbers for the rates, as I was showing you earlier. And it's pretty wide in our three orders of magnitude. And as you can see, we're not even touching yet the upper limit of what people think is possible. But that will change in advanced LIGO. And these dashed lines indicate the realistic rates, or as it says, realistic. We're slightly less sensitive to spin, as these numbers indicate, because we use non-spinning templates. And so we also assess sensitivity to spin. But it's not a huge effect in this mass regime at this sensitivity. So we actually do pretty well, I think. It's the most annoying program ever. Okay, so that's S5 or S6, and I have about 10 minutes left. I'll probably just whiz through the rest of this. Looking forward to advanced LIGO, there's some new challenges. So LIGO is going to have improved, or advanced LIGO is going to have improved sensitivity down to about 15 hertz. If you want to take advantage of this and filter or have templates that are filtering from 15 hertz, then it's going to require you to use templates that are up to 30 minutes long. And using the current methods that we use for filtering, this is a pretty big problem. So we won't lose detection efficiency because of that problem. But we will lose latency because we use FFTs to do the match filter. And so this introduces a latency of at least the length of the template. And if you have a 30-minute latency in producing triggers, you're never going to see an afterglow. Well, you won't see an afterglow, a GRB afterglow. But there's also, the reason why detection efficiency is on here is because we've been using non-spinning templates up to this point, and recently spinning templates or spin-aligned templates have become available, and we'd like to start incorporating these into the search in order to improve detection efficiency. We also gain a little bit of detection efficiency in going from 40 hertz to 15 hertz, because there's a good amount of SNR down there. And that's what this plot shows. So this is the, on the horizontal axis is the low frequency cutoff, And as a function of the low frequency cutoff, the increase in observed volume, which corresponds to the increase in detection rate. So by going down to 15 hertz, we can increase the detection rate by more than 50%. And so that's a strong incentive to push to that limit. But in addition to going to improving your detection rate, you also have to deal with templates that are as long as 600 seconds. And even if you only wanted to go down to 25 hertz or something like that, you still have to deal with templates that are 200 seconds. And all of these are much longer than any templates we had to deal with in initial LIGO. I think the longest one was about 30 seconds. Is that right? 40 seconds. Yeah, so and we also want to have low latency because we want to work with electromagnetic observations to improve our the science that we can make from LIGO detections. So there's actually a lot of different ways that a binary neutron star can have an electromagnetic counterpart. I think perhaps the most commonly talked about are GRBs, but these are beamed. And so we don't see all those. Gravitational waves, however, are not strongly beamed. So it's very possible that we could detect a binary neutron star and not see the GRB itself. But there's still other types of afterglows that we can observe, and the latency is crucial here. So we have some optical afterglows that occur when the jet starts to slow down by hitting the medium surrounding the event. And these last for timescales of days. You can have radio afterglows that last for years. You don't really need low latency for that. But some of the optical afterglows are about a day, and let's see, there's lots of different time scales and lots of different bands to observe in. They'll help with detection confidence, also localization of the event in the sky. LIGO is because of the way the interferometers are built, they're actually sensitive to the gravitational waves from many different directions, which is a great thing when you want to detect, but it's a bad thing when you want to localize it on the sky, because we can see in every direction, so we have things coming from everywhere. Understanding the coalescence aftermath, like this story here that's depicted here is not completely understood, so I think this could shed more light into that, and also, of course, the origin of short, hard GRBs. I think I'm running out of time. So this is just, I think I've covered this already. The only thing I'll mention is also the minimum lock stretch for estimating your PSD. Based on the methods that we use, we require we measure the PSD by splitting the data up into little window or little chunks, overlapping chunks, and compute the power spectrum in each of these chunks and then average them in some way. And this is a robust estimator of the PSD, provided that your template doesn't sit in more than one or two of these little windows. If your template, your signal. If your signal is in that entire stretch, then it's going to corrupt the estimate of the PSD. So we have to have a PSD that's about a factor of 10 longer than the longest template, which means we have to keep our detector in lock for 1,000 consecutive seconds in order to even have analyzable data. And so we need to be able to efficiently handle gaps. And the claim is that these problems are naturally solved by a stream-based approach to CVC searches. And that's what Kip and Chad and I are working on this, well, not just this week, but So there's a couple tricks that we can use to speed up things. And one of which is that we can take advantage of the very somewhat simple structure of the CVC waveforms and multi-band them. So we can split the analysis up into, so for instance here, the first 15 seconds of the waveform can be sampled at 128 hertz because it doesn't have any frequency components above 64 hertz. So whereas previously we would sample the entire waveform at 2048 hertz, here we can gain a lot of speed up by taking the first 15 seconds and decimating it and downsampling to 128 hertz. So another feature of, I've mentioned that we'll have a lot more templates, and we need to have some way of reducing or effectively reducing the number of templates that we have to use. And so our template banks are actually highly correlated by design because we don't want to miss anything. So we spread them out over parameter space rather densely so that if a signal has some parameters that maybe isn't in your template bank but close, you'll still detect it with 97, what we usually record is 97% minimum mismatch, which means we'll detect at least 90% of this yes and no. But the fact that they are highly correlated means that we can do something of a principal component analysis of your template bank, and then filter with this principal component basis. So here you see a physical template bank. These are the chirp waveforms being transformed into the principal components. And down here, these waveforms are just, they don't contribute much to your signal to noise, so you can just throw them out. And a singular value decomposition tells you which one is important. And so you lose a little bit of SNR, but you gain in computational speed.
There's one other important thing, and that's the accuracy of the templates. Right? So you already mentioned that a little bit. Is the accuracy more or less uniform across the template bank? So obviously that's a hard question to answer without actually having an accurate set of templates. But do you have any way to assess that?
I would say you could argue easily that it's not, because what ends up happening is, in GR you might have just like you showed. In GR you have, you can scale everything, like pull mass out of the problem or whatever. But with a real noise curve, you have units that make sense in terms of frequencies.
Right.
The point is that we probably trust all waveforms less towards the end, as they're all part of some expansion, which we need to know where it is, and all kinds of crazy stuff like that with the end waveforms. So anything that has basically that spends, that has a very high merger, is probably going to be more accurate.
So then you worry when you construct these linear combinations that you're mixing your worst known templates in your best known templates and getting systematic uncertainties that are very large across the bank.
We actually do it in small patches. So the whole crazy curve signal manifold that would be the entire hundreds of thousands of template bank, we don't attempt to do a principal component analysis on that. It wouldn't really be worth it. So it's actually done in very small patches, choosing chirp bands, which is already the sensible principal analysis anyway. So it's not a big deal.
A different question is, so you mentioned this thing about how if you look at the fraction of the waveform that is the part of the spiral that's further from merger, so that it's, let's say, oscillating at less than 128 hertz or whatever, and so you only have to sample that 256 hertz to micro sample it. But so that you would have to sample at 256 hertz. It seems like actually you could sample much less. I mean, I'm not sure I understand the logic. Like if you had a random signal with no frequency components above 128 hertz, then you would have to sample it at 256 hertz and no higher.
But what you actually have is almost perfectly.
You're asking, can you heterodyne? Basically, do a nonlinear transformation because the bandwidth of the signal is actually much shorter than the sample rate that we're talking about.
Yeah,
heterodyne is one of the things that's been talked about in hallways in previous use cases. I don't know that. People that want to try it. I mean, it's an added complexity to the whole thing, and it's not good that it's a huge win over just doing the naive thing.
Is that used by the continuous wave folks?
In other words, you might think that for 10 samples over 100 cycles would be enough to really uniquely determine which guy you're looking at. Or stated another way, I guess if your template bank is parameterized by n parameters, then if you have n perfect measurements of that, then that's all you need, no matter how many samples.
Yeah.
So I mean, of course, you don't have perfect measurements. I understand, but I mean, it seems like the number of samples you need is determined by the number of parameters of your signal to noise ratio. The number of parameters of your signal to noise ratio, not really by the frequency.
No, and the pattern of nonlinear transformations proposed that has to deal with this. Like, there was a graduate student at Caltech in the 80s or 90s. Who proposed the idea that you would nonlinearly sample the data in time, and the power law you would choose to do that was the dominant phasing, the dominant time frequency term, so T to the thirds or whatever. And then the Fourier transform was the transformation and told you what the term transform was. And so I think that's kind of what you're thinking of, in some sense.
No, I think it's literally heterodyne.
I'm just sort of saying, it seems to me like the number of data points that you want to take on a given curve is almost unrelated to the frequency of the wave.
I think they're actually
because it's not like a random signal you're trying to measure. It's a sent signal with n free parameters. Parameters and signal.
But it's still quite broad band. I mean, instantaneously it's narrow band, but obviously, from the start to the end, it
seems
the whole frequency.
That's true.
Yeah. But in a way, it's only parameterized by, let's say, 10 parameters.
I think it's a somewhat different question. You said the bad word up front, that makes it sound good, that's perfect. So if you have perfect measurements, right. If you have imperfect measurements, then how many points you need doesn't depend upon the signal to noise ratio of the measurements necessarily, but it also depends upon the degeneracy of the parameters. Okay, so if you have one parameter that makes a very, very small difference in the signal at a given time, then measurements, imperfect measurements, tell you very little information, right? About what that parameter should be.
Yeah, I mean, I would have said if you want to work out the Fisher matrix approach would say you want to pile up all of your given n parameters you want to measure. You take as many measurements as you want, but you want to pile them as much as possible in the region where the signal changes very rapidly because of changing those parameters, which presumably is at the high frequency end. And if you make a small change in the parameters and ask how big is the cross correlation, how much does the cross correlation between template signal change as you vary those parameters you're trying to fit.
It
must be a bigger effect in the high frequency.
It's actually, I think it's the opposite of what's true. Most of the trip mass measurement, which is the fundamental component of it, pretty interesting because it's the first, it's the best estimated revolutionary parameter period. Most of the measurement will actually comes from both of those.
Okay.
And that's just because of the long duration?
Long duration. This is a lot of opportunity to fit that way.
Okay.
It'd be interesting to talk to you more about this because I think this is one of these weird things that's sort of looking about waveforms and kind of searches and analysis a lot. Maybe there aren't a lot of good ideas.
So I guess I'll actually end with this. I have some slides on spinning templates, but I think we're out of time. And this just neatly summarizes some of the ideas that I've discussed, which, by the way, aren't my ideas. And so at least the template downsampling has been used before in previous searches. And so you start up here with your data. I suppose optionally add some injections and whiten your data, and then you tee it off and conduct and create four different data streams, and you downsample these data streams based on how you've decided your waveform is going to be filtered, right? And so here is the lowest frequency component of your waveform. Sometimes there are two of these just because it's convenient. It's not like if it spends 15 minutes in this band, we still want to break it up even further. And then these are the higher frequency components. So we filter against those non-physical templates that I was talking about. And there's a step here. So you don't know actually if it's shown here, but does that... That's composite statistic, or is that compute statistic? Okay, so I don't know the status of this, but you in principle should be able to compute based on your orthogonal SNRs some sort of excess power statistic that says, hey, there's something here. I don't know what it is, but you need to go back to your physical parameters so that we can see what it is. And then... the SVD also gives you the instructions for how to reconstruct back to your physical template. So if this composite statistic says, hey, reconstruct, then you go up here and add the SNRs and then convert them into your physical templates. Take the loudest one, and that's your trigger. And so that's the workflow. And it all happens in a streaming time-based way. So it keeps up with the data, and it can... deal with long templates and pass over gaps and things like that. I think I'll stop there, and just I want to say thank you. So thank you to Perimeter Institute for hosting this visit, and to Chad Hanna and Kip Cannon, who are in the room right here. Also, Drew Keppel. Drew Keppel, Nick Fotopoulos, and Larry Price, they're some of my favorite academic mentors and inspiration superstars. Alan Weinstein is also an inspiration superstar, but he gets a line of his own because he's my thesis advisor, and I'd like to thank the LIGO Scientific and Virgo collaborations. Well, I'm from Los Angeles. That's why I included the gracias. Yes, there's a bit of a choice. I'm going to put all of them.